Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Welcome back, Sharkies, to Sharkpedia. We are so excited to be back today to talk about stress physiology. We have Alex here today. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're at in your studies?
Cool. So my name is Alex Schoen, and I am a PhD candidate at the University of Manitoba under the supervision of Dr. Gary Anderson. I study shark physiology and stress physiology. And I guess I look specifically at the dominant hormone in sharks, which is 1-alpha hydroxycorticosterone.
I'm so excited. I am also studying stress physiology, or trying to. I'm learning how to with seven-gill sharks, so I'm really excited to have you here today. I'm going to geek out quite a lot, and hopefully our listeners can geek out with us.
Megan sounds like she's low-key fangirling.
I am fangirling. Are you kidding me?
That's so nice.
There's not many people that have, like, done this work with 1-alpha hydroxycorticosteroid. Did I say that right? Oh, yes.
Yeah, so in the States, they pronounce it, or I can't remember, because I'm actually from the States, but they don't pronounce it corticosterone. They pronounce it corticosterone. They pronounce it corticosterone.
Oh, so really?
Yeah, so whenever I go down to the States, it's always like trying to remember, oh, it's a different pronunciation. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, I just call it 1-alpha for short. Do you have a term that you call it for short?
Yeah, so I call it 1-alpha-B. So okay. I'll probably refer to it as 1-alpha-B just because corticosterone, the Kendall's compound name for it is B. So, which is basically just all different hormones have different lettering names for some reason.
Oh, okay.
There's a reason why, I just completely forgot why, but corticosterone is B.
Okay, cool. So we'll call it 1-alpha-B.
Cool.
Cool. I don't have to butcher trying to say it every single time for the rest of the episode.
I'm just proud of myself for saying it correctly one time. And it was recorded. So.
Round of applause.
There you go.
So we haven't done any sort of stress physiology episode yet, which is why we're super excited to have you. And before we kind of talk about this paper and read the summary for the purpose of listeners not getting lost immediately in the first 5 seconds of the episode, let's just like define broadly what stress physiology is in sharks and kind of talk about how it shows up in them. So if we can kind of try to relate this to people so that our listeners can kind of understand what's happening in their bodies and then how that happens in sharks' bodies, that would be super great.
Cool, yeah. So the study of physiology is essentially the study of bodily functions. So this could be from a tissue level, so looking at organs, the whole organ, all the way down to an enzymatic level, or sometimes even molecular is part of the physiological process. And how I have described it in the past is kids, if you are taking a test and you your palms get sweaty and your heart starts racing, that's the stress response, essentially. And how that differs from normal physiology, how stress physiology differs, is that if you consider normal physiology as the study of homeostasis, so your body under baseline conditions, you can consider stress physiology as a deviation from homeostasis. So when your body is deviating away from baseline conditions for whatever reason, and then it also includes getting back to homeostasis, so getting back to those baseline conditions. So in humans, I use the example of you're taking a test, My advisor uses the example of you step in front of a bus and you're going to be stressed out. So he uses that example in his classes.
That's a terrifying example.
I know it is.
I like yours more.
I do too. And especially if when I'm explaining this to kids, I'm like, I'm not going to tell them that, you know, if they're going to be run over by a bus. But yeah, so there's that. Yeah, so that's basically the basis of it. And then if you're a shark, you have different stressors, obviously. So in the paper, we looked at primarily a thermal stress, which is very pertinent for climate change and global warming. In my other work, we've looked at air exposure stress just as a proxy stress. So trying to do some kind of stress response just to essentially see what will happen. So.
Yeah, like see how the shark's body reacts, right? Like how are you measuring that?
Right. So I think that was also something that you sent me as well was there's different phases of the stress response.
Yeah.
So people look at it different ways, but there's kind of a basic understanding that there's a primary response, a secondary response, and a tertiary response. So the primary response is the initial perception of a stressor and release of catecholamines. So talking about adrenaline, noradrenaline, things that are going to have a really, really quick response. Talking about like seconds, response in seconds. And then there's a secondary stress response where you have a release of energy metabolites, which is primarily glucose in vertebrates, and secondary changes. So constriction of blood vessels and a release of corticosteroids, which is the stress hormone, so cortisol in humans and other mammals, and increased heart rate. So just different physiological responses. And then the tertiary response is actual whole body response. So behavioral responses or immune responses. Those kind of things.
Yeah, like the things that like affect your overall fitness, like how healthy you might be, right? Would chronic stress like kind of fall into that tertiary response? Like if you're getting chronic stress, then it starts actually affecting your health. Like, you know, when exams are coming up, I would say that I'm under chronic stress.
Oh, for sure. Like anxiety in humans, like that's prime example of like a chronic stress where it's going to start affecting your long-term physiology and it's going to affect your health. It's going to affect, I always use the heart rate example. Like you're going to have an increased heart rate, like, for a longer term, and that's going to affect other things. So there's also the acute versus chronic phase as well.
Awesome. Well, I think that gives us a really good kind of background baseline. So I'll go ahead and give the article summary for the article that you wrote about stress physiology, and then we'll talk about how you actually measured it for this study and what you kind of concluded, because it's so cool and I can't wait. Okay, so the title of this article is Simulated Heat Wave and Fishing Stressors Alter Corticosteroid and Energy Balance in Neonate Blacktip Reef Sharks, Carcharhinus melanopterus. So the summary of this article is, as global climate change continues to be a really big topic of concern, ocean surface temperatures are also expected to increase. Those warming ocean temperatures can pose a really big threat to many marine organisms, as increased temperatures and frequency of heat waves can surpass an animal's tolerance. And if they can't avoid the warmer area, this can be a really big problem, right? So particularly with juvenile elasmobranch species, they inhabit like really shallow areas along the coastline and nearshore areas. And those could be of higher risk for increasing temperatures because there's less water depth and there's therefore like less buffer for if there's a big heat wave. So with those increasing temperatures, combined with anthropogenic impacts, which are human-influenced impacts such as recreational fishing, both of those things combined can start to pose an even greater risk to overall fitness of the animal. So to test this, Alex and her colleagues tested thermal and anthropogenic stress impacts on shark fitness, and they investigated several stress indicators in the blood of neonate blacktip reef sharks, Carcharhinus melanopterus in Moorea, French Polynesia, which is also really cool.
Absolutely. So before we kind of dive into the deeper questions that we have, I think we should start out by just explaining why studying the stress of sharks is so important to their conservation, but also just to who they are as a species as a whole.
Yeah, definitely. So studying the stress of any animal is important for conservation. You want to know how these either natural or human-imposed stressors are going to affect the animal, particularly looking into the future. So how are heat waves going to affect the animal long-term? And that also goes back into acute and chronic stressors. So heat waves, you could consider that an acute stressor based on how long the heat wave is. So that could be a very short-term thermal exposure, versus climate change as a whole is a chronic stressor where you're going to have you can have long-term physiological changes. You essentially just want to know long-term what's going to happen with the species, and you're not going to know population or ecological effects until you know what's happening with the animal individually or the animal as a species.
Cool. So I also want to point out for our listeners, on top of all the things that you just said, the difference kind of between how stress affects humans versus sharks. One of the biggest things that stress can do to sharks is eventually kill them. When people recreationally fish, or if you do research on sharks, right, we have all these protocols with how to handle them, because their actual stress physiology and the physiological changes that they experience can lead to death quite quickly, depending on how stressed out they get. Whereas in people, if I'm really stressed out during finals, for example, and I have an anxiety attack, it's not likely to kill me. I'm likely to be able to come out of that and be okay, right? I survived all my finals in college. I'm still here. I'm not a ghost. But if a shark gets really stressed out, that can eventually kill them, which is something that I want to point out for our readers as to why stress physiology is also really important, because the buildup of something like chronic stress could eventually lead to the death of an animal. And so with conserving them, we want to know sort of how these effects might affect them, so that in the long term, we can understand things like what their population might look like, or how their overall physiology might change.
Well, the other thing, too, you make such a good point, is that not only could it pose a risk of them dying, but if they are spending so much energy with physiological stress, they're not using that energy towards things like reproduction or actually going out and hunting and eating. So, yeah, it could, the stress alone could kill them, but it also impacts like the population level. If they're all busy being stressed, they're not getting busy. And so that can end up... that could end up being, you know, harmful.
Yeah. There's also, along those lines, there's a lot of, not many people have done this in sharks. There have been the Carolyn Wheeler and Jody Rummer's lab is the last person, I think, to look into this. But looking at maternal effects and transgenerational stress, there's a lot of evidence in fish, just teleost species, that also impacts the population. So if a fish is stressed, they might pass that on to their offspring in some cases as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's really cool and also terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you're just born stressed out.
Oh, no. That's not a very happy life.
No, it's not. Okay, so I think I want to break down for our listeners, because in the article summary, I didn't even really talk about at all how you measured this or how what you even found. I just kind of gave a really brief background on why it's important and where you kind of did this and looked at this. So let's kind of break down for our listeners. You had basically three different experimental groups, one for thermal stress, one for air exposure, and then you had a different treatment group in wild sharks, because the thermal stress and air exposure experiments were actually done in a captive state. So can mm-hmm. you kind of explain how you set this up? How did you start to go out and explore how thermal stress and anthropogenic impacts could impact this species?
Right. So I guess the basic methods, what we did was we went out and we trapped these, or netted these baby sharks every night, and brought them back into the lab. And we actually, the thermal exposure and the air exposure was done in the same fish. So we did either a control or an increased temperature group. And then they were all air exposed for 1 minute, and that was considered time zero. And then we looked at them for 48 hours after. The wild sharks were actually really opportunistic. That was not part of the plan at all, but ended up happening. And basically, we went out and line fished for not only baby sharks, neonate sharks, but adults as well. And we were able to get a decent number. And for those wild fish, we didn't look at them for 48 hours. We weren't going to be able to keep them for 48 hours. So it was a 5 minute treatment where we took a blood sample and then did a morphometric workup for another study and then took another blood sample afterwards. So their stressor per se was just being handled on the side of the boat or on the side of the dock. It was in some cases just some random person's house. So really just depended on the situation.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm looking at in Seven Gills too, is like, how is handling affecting their physiology? Taking that kind of timestamp of you get that blood draw right when they get on board to try to get it as that baseline as quick as possible, and then measure after getting all of our other samples, taking another blood sample to see how their physiology changed while we were handling them. I think that can be really good for us to know, right? Because we want to know how our handling and how our techniques also impact that animal's overall fitness.
Yeah, and it's definitely, it is a good stress proxy, as long as, you know, it's definitely repeatable. It's very repeatable. And that's something in my work that's very important, is we're just trying to find a proxy for stress. It doesn't necessarily matter what the stressor is. And in this paper, in terms of conservation, it definitely does with thermal stress. But if we're trying to study the stress response as a whole, if it's handling stress or if it's just air exposure or something like that, just having a good repeatable stress event is definitely good. And holding them on the side of the boat is probably the most simple thing you can do, which is like very, very repeatable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Okay, so let's maybe focus on those captive sharks first. So can you kind of walk us through that whole process? What were you measuring and how did you measure it?
Right. So we were looking at a proxy for a thermal event, so a heat wave event, and then a proxy for some kind of fishing event. So that was air exposure. So what we did is we had our control group, which was kept at 27 degrees Celsius, and our heat wave group, which was kept at 29 degrees Celsius. And one thing that we were asked a lot was, is 2 degrees going to matter in these fish? And it does, actually. It does actually matter, which is super interesting.
It is so interesting. And actually, like, that's exactly what I was just about to say, is a lot of people, when we talk about climate change and we talk about 1 degree Celsius in the next couple of years, and people are like, it's 1 degree, but like, don't really understand how that can actually cascade down to the species level. So I actually love that you only did 2 degrees difference, so that you could show, even with 2 degrees, how strong that physiological response can be. I just think it's really important that we understand how that's going to change at each degree level.
Oh, I totally agree. And it's even more important because when we were fishing for these sharks, it was 31 degrees in the water.
Oh my gosh.
So they were even dealing in the wild with temperatures beyond what we had exposed them to.
Wow.
So it is definitely it's happening right now. Like, these temperatures are happening right now.
Oh my gosh.
So that was our thermal exposure. And then they had 2 days, I believe, 2 days to acclimate to that temperature. And then they were air exposed for a minute. So that was the fishing event. So we're looking at synergistic stress events that could very likely happen in the wild. So we have the temperature that's actually happening. And then these fish do get caught as bycatch. French Polynesia is a shark sanctuary, so they're not targeted. But you're going to have fish as bycatch in any situation. So that was a real life event, could have happened. And then we monitored them for took a blood sample at 30 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours and 48 hours and time zero. So that was the captive, the captive experiment.
Yeah. And I just want to emphasize really quick too that air exposure, because some listeners might be like, why were you exposing that animal to air for a minute? And that really actually, I think, is pretty conservative, because if you think about it, sure, some fishers are getting those animals, they're getting them off the hook, they're posing for pictures with that animal. And so that animal is actually out of water for sometimes several minutes. So just to get our listeners like comfortable with that concept of why you did that, yeah, you're lifting the animal out of water for a minute just so you can see how 60 seconds can make a difference. And that's why it's good that you're even, again, being conservative with those numbers, so you can see, yeah, if you extrapolate that to 5 minutes, which definitely also happens with fishers, you can see how that can really start to snowball effect on their physiology.
Absolutely. Just a little anecdote on that. For my other side of my research with spiny dogfish off the coast of British Columbia, we air exposed those for 10 minutes. So those fish, and they don't really seem to care. So it kind of just depends on the fish, what they totally can deal with.
Yeah.
So it is a very conservative number.
I think now is a good time to tell my favorite shark being exposed to air story, which is in Florida, because Florida, I can't say I'm surprised that this happened. A guy caught a nurse shark and brought it to a grocery store to try and sell. And the police came and obviously were like, put the shark back or get rid of it. And he put the shark back in the ocean and it was still alive and probably lived, considering that it was a nurse shark and they don't get that stressed out, which I think is not so surprised. Ridiculous. Like, how do you, what?
That's so funny. Some of these benthic sharks are crazy. They can survive so long under such weird stress conditions.
Yeah, I don't understand, which I think is another important point for our listeners to get, which is that different species of sharks experience stress differently and react to stress very differently. Nurse sharks are known to be very hardy and can like be out of water for, I guess, however long they want to be, and then be put back and be fine. Whereas we have other sharks like hammerheads, where we have very strict protocols with research because they get stressed out so quickly that you can end up killing like a 12-foot hammerhead for having them out of the water for maybe 3 minutes, even with water flowing over their gills. So all of this research, even just 1 minute of airtime, some sharks would experience that as a very high stress situation and others would not. So that's why it's important to even do small amounts of airtime and see kind of what that reaction would be.
I do want to say that these fish were released also afterwards back into the wild, so they did survive.
Yes, good. That's good to clarify. And I also want to clarify for our sharkies real quick. Just because nurse sharks are really hardy, please do not lift them out of the water. If you don't have the permits to handle them, please just don't. But I also think this is, we should have also introduced the species that you're researching, because we forgot to do that. And black-tipped reef sharks, they're not benthic, meaning they're not on the bottom of the ocean, but they're actually kind of mid-water column. They're called reef sharks, right? Because they're hanging out on the reef. They're swimming above coral reef systems. So if our listeners aren't familiar with black-tipped reef sharks, they're a really common shark that you might see on a coral reef. They're really cool. You should look them up.
Yeah, they're very cool.
So you air exposed the neonates, which are like the freshly born pups, after they were acclimated up to that 29 degrees, and then you exposed them for 60 seconds. And then what did you do?
Yeah, so exposed them for 60 seconds, took our blood samples, and then back in the lab, and this we did this as well with the wild sharks as well, we looked at the plasma. So that's the part where you take out all the blood cells and take out everything that's in the blood, and you just have that clear part left. And that's where all your metabolites, energy metabolites, all your hormones are going to be. And we looked at two energy metabolites, so glucose, which is the predominant energy metabolite in vertebrates, or that's mobilized under stress conditions in vertebrates, and beta hydroxybutyrate, which is it's called a ketone body, and it is derived from lipids, so fats in vertebrates and too. So mammals actually use ketone bodies to fuel the brain when under low glucose conditions. So you'll use ketone bodies to fuel your brain. But the interesting thing about sharks, as far as we know, is that they are ketone, or they're ketogenic, basically meaning that they use ketone bodies under both starved and fed conditions. Oh, I should have mentioned also that we use ketone bodies under starved conditions. Humans and mammals use ketone bodies under starved conditions. But sharks use it all the time. So essentially, sharks are in this constant state of ketosis, which is very different from other fish, very different from other vertebrates. So that's why we measured ketones. And then we also measured two corticosteroids, so two hormones, corticosterone, which we mentioned earlier, and then 1-alpha-B, so 1-alpha-hydroxycorticosterone. And 1-alpha-B is the dominant corticosteroid in elastobranchs, but it is currently unclear if it has a role in the stress response. So,
oh, really?
That's
oh yeah, for sure. Oh, I can go. I can talk about that forever.
So I do just want to say in like a relatively plain sentence, all of the different kind of chemical bodies that we just talked about, basically what's happening in a shark is they're using those for different things like metabolism or energy. And those can either increase or decrease in stress scenarios or just in life in general.
Yes. And that's actually really important because there are different studies that are showing that sharks may use glucose in some cases or may use ketones in some cases, or it's tissue specific. So the rectal gland in sharks, which is responsible for partially responsible for osmoregulation, so mineral balance, is largely glucose dependent, but it needs ketones in order to function properly. Whereas the heart is largely ketone dependent. We don't really know. Like, we don't really know which metabolites are being used under which circumstances. White muscle is another one where, for what we know so far, it looks like it's ketone dependent, but uses glucose under certain situations, uses lactate potentially under certain situations. I'm sure people will get mad at me for saying that. That is a really good point that under different situations, under different stressors, it is still very unclear what sharks are using.
And so 1-alpha-B, which is also a hormone that I hope to figure out how to measure in seven-gill sharks, you're saying that's not necessarily known whether or not it like is part of the stress response?
Yeah, so I guess the stress response can be, or corticosteroids, which are released under stress conditions, not only under stress conditions, but classically invertebrates are released under stress conditions. So again, that's like cortisol in humans is a corticosteroid, is our dominant stress corticosteroid. So we know that 1-alpha-B has a role in mineral regulation. So under osmotic stress, so for example, increased salt water challenges. Like, so we see 1-alpha-B may have a role in, or does have a role in regulating osmotic balance. However, no one has looked at metabolic balance. So looking at energy balance in sharks during the stress response. So that's where my paper comes in, as well as a paper I previously wrote in the spiny dogfish. So looking at the correlation between 1-alpha-B and these energy metabolites, what have I found is that there was no correlation during the stress response between 1-alpha-B and glucose. There potentially was a very weak correlation between 1-alpha-B and ketones in spiny dogfish. And in the black tips in this paper, there was no correlation at all between either metabolite and 1-alpha-B. So that's not to say 1-alpha-B is not a stress hormone. It's just, in my mind, that points that this is much more complicated than we imagine. That 1-alpha-B may have a role in energy balance, but it may not have a role alone. It may be another hormone that's doing it. It may be a synergistic effect with another hormone. It may be a hormone that completely different that we still don't know is there.
Corticosteroid and 1-alpha-B are likely having different roles here, right? I just want to be very sure about that.
Oh, corticosterone?
Corticosterone, thank you.
Sorry, yeah, 1-alpha-B and then corticosterone, which is B. So 1-alpha-B and B. We don't know. That's the other thing. We just don't know anything. Basically,
well, I've looked
very little. So B, or corticosterone, did have a very weak correlation with glucose in the spiny dogfish. But again, these are all really weak correlations. And then again, exactly what was said before, it might be different stress situations that trigger different responses. So the one thing we do know is that it doesn't seem to be as clear cut as what it is in mammals. it seems to be very different, more complicated, for sure.
Yeah. Yes, it's definitely complicated, and especially for us and probably for our listeners as well. If you're not a physiologist, this can start to feel really overwhelming really quick when there's so many different metabolites. So let's kind of back up for a second and just state for our listeners and also for me, because I want to make sure that I understand this. With the animals that you air exposed, what increased and what decreased?
For sure. So I actually have to pull that paper up again. That's answered off the top of my head. So in respects to thermal stress, which is, I think, one of the highlights of this paper, we saw glucose increase with increasing temperature. And that was overall. So glucose increase was significantly different from time zero to time 48 hours.
And glucose is that secondary stress response, right? Like they're dumping glucose to use because they're stressed out and they need energy. So they're going to take that glucose so that they can like get out of that situation.
Yeah. So classically in invertebrates, what's going to happen is, yeah, you have some corticosteroid that's being dumped into the bloodstream, and then that's going to stimulate mobilization of these energy metabolites. So yeah. So we assume we have some corticosteroid that's binding to receptors in the liver or the muscle or something, and then that's going to release glucose. And so what this data potentially shows is that, yeah, there was an increase in mobilizing glucose in the plasma with increasing temperature. Interestingly, we saw a decrease in BHB, or in this case, we measured 3-HB, which is a cheaper version of BHB. The BHB enzyme is pretty expensive, so this one was a cheaper version. It's the same thing. And we saw a decrease in BHB, which is super interesting because in my previous work, as well as other people's previous work who has measured both of these metabolites at the same time, almost everyone has seen an inverse relationship between glucose and BHB. So I thought that was interesting because, again, we're just showing in another species that there is this inverse relationship between these metabolites.
And BHB is, just to be clear, a hormone, right?
No, so BHB is another energy metabolite, which is the one that is derived from lipids.
Okay, got it.
So it's the ketone body. It's the ketone body.
Got it. Okay, yeah. Good. See, even we get lost with this guy, so it's good.
Sorry, and like I talk really fast too.
No, it's okay. No, there's just so much here, and it's like so interesting to me because those inverse relationships are really interesting. Like, why do you think that is? Like, why do you think glucose would increase, but a ketone body, which is lipid derived, would decrease?
Yeah, that is a super interesting thing. I don't know for sure, and I do think, again, it's under different situations, different metabolites are being used, different energy sources are being used. There is one other paper that looks at these energy metabolites seasonally, and it showed an increase in glucose in warmer temperatures or warmer seasons, so summer, increased temperatures in the summer and then a decrease in BHB in the summer. Hmm. So it might just be some physiological regulation that we don't understand yet. But it is interesting to see that in several different species.
Yeah, it is super interesting. Okay, so that's what you saw with the thermal tolerance. And what did you see with the air exposure
treatment? Yeah, so with the air exposure, we did see an increase in glucose as well as a decrease in BHB. Not so much as drastic as what we saw with the thermal event, but it is what we expected, that there was this increase. Because there are countless studies, I'm sure you know, there are countless studies that show, okay, you take a fish out of the water, it's going to get stressed out, or it's going to mobilize glucose. So that I'm glad we saw that. It's a nice validation that this does happen. And I think the interesting thing with 1-alpha-B was that we didn't see a change in 1-alpha-B following air exposure, but we did see a difference in patterns with thermal exposure. So at the control temperature at 27 degrees, we saw what we saw in the spiny dogfish as well. We did see an increase in 1-alpha-B. It wasn't significant, but we did see an increase in 1-alpha-B. And then a maintenance of 1-alpha-B over those 48 hours. So it's remained high over those 48 hours. However, with the 29 degrees, we did see an increase in 1-alpha following the increased temperature, but then it didn't remain high. It went back down to baseline. There was no significant difference across the board. Mm. Which I thought that was very interesting, because to me, it kind of points towards either hormonal dysregulation potentially under higher temperatures. So potentially the hormones are not being mobilized in the same way as they would under control temperatures, or potentially, that might be due to dysregulation. So something that's going wrong. Or that might be an adaptation, because maybe they're saving energy because they have to deal with these higher temperatures.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Oh, yeah. That's so cool. I mean, there's still so much here. I feel like, honestly, we could do a whole episode just trying to break down the things that you're measuring, because like it's so much information. And like you said, we just don't know a lot. So trying to make sense of these metabolites, as you said, and 1-alpha-B that we're just still learning so much about can be like, it's just a lot, but it's so cool. So then let's talk about those wild sharks. So you saw some really cool patterns with those captive sharks by showing that they do have some pretty strong sort of stress physiological response to thermal and air exposure. What did you find in the wild? Because in the wild, you compared those neonate or like young sharks to adult sharks, and you saw some really cool differences that I have some questions about. So let's talk about that.
Definitely. So again, that methodology was looking at, you had the blood sample and then 5 minutes and then another blood sample. So for glucose, what we saw was that there was a difference between neonates and adults. We didn't see any difference over the 5 minutes in either age category, which I thought was interesting. So potentially 5 minutes of being handled is not a significant stressor under these conditions, but we did see higher glucose in neonates than we saw in adults, and then conversely, we saw higher 1-alpha-B in adults rather than glucose. So we have some kind of an inverse relationship between those as well.
Yeah, I feel like you're like lowballing this so much. Like, this is so cool to me. Like, I just really want our listeners to understand, like, the juvenile sharks clearly were using glucose and the adults were clearly using 1-alpha-B, right?
Yeah, so kind of different things. So the glucose is the metabolite, and then 1-alpha-B is the hormone or the corticosteroid. So the juveniles, it's really interesting that they had higher glucose. We think potentially because, as one of my co-authors likes to put it, Ian Boyukos, he's second author on that paper, he likes to put it as mom has packed a lunch. So when the babies are born, they have like a packed lunch in their liver that's already...
Oh my gosh.
Like,
it's a Lunchable.
Isn't that cute? Yeah. It's super cute. I really like that a lot. Where they have this like this glucose or this energy source that they already have while they're learning and figuring out how to eat food on their own. So that might be something that is contributing to that higher glucose. It could also be, we don't know the feeding status of these animals, so it could be that these animals had just eaten.
Let's make sure that our listeners understand why that's important too, right? Because why would it matter if they ate recently?
Right. So when you eat, you're going to have, first of all, you're either going to use these metabolites or you're going to use the food or you're going to store the food. And in the case of usually more juvenile animals, you're using a lot of energy in order to grow. So that is one of the things that potentially it might be where they're using more of these metabolites. They have more mobilized in order to actually grow quickly and not get eaten. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
So just to touch on the 1-alpha-B, I thought that was the interesting thing for sure, was that 1-alpha we know is mobilized from the interrenal gland inside of the sharks, which is comparable to the adrenal gland in humans or in other vertebrates. So we saw that the 1-alpha-B, there's higher concentrations of 1-alpha-B in adults, which, again, this is speculative, which could be potentially because the machinery is not there yet. It has not been developed yet, the interrenal gland, in order to make 1-alpha-B. But that is completely speculative.
In the juveniles.
Yeah, in the juveniles.
Yeah, so is that measured? Like, do juveniles not have that gland yet that would produce 1-alpha-B?
Yeah, and that hasn't been looked at before. That is something that would be super cool to do. Someone should do it. And I don't, the issue is getting like the permits probably in order to sacrifice some juveniles, but and we could probably totally do that with the dogfish. They're not an endangered species. They're very abundant, and that's why we're able to do a lot of physiological work on them. Mm-hmm. But they have a 2-year gestation period. So
2 year.
Yeah. And the probability of catching a baby is very, very small.
Yeah. 2 years. Whoa. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's crazy.
This is why we science, everyone, because we don't actually know anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to find it out. Oh, that's so cool. I just thought that was like one of the coolest things that you found as well, that you would see 1-alpha-B in the adults but not the juveniles. And I thought that your theory about potentially the I keep wanting to call it adrenal gland. What's it called again?
Interrenal
gland. So maybe they just haven't developed that yet. I think that is such an interesting theory. And like the thought of like what we call ontogenetic shifts, the shifts in life stage, like how it would shift from a juvenile to an adult, is so interesting to me. I'm looking at juvenile sharks in San Francisco Bay with Seven Gill sharks. And I'm working actually with some of the same collaborators you worked with to measure 1-alpha-B to see potentially, I wonder, I mean, I'm looking at juveniles in general, but I would be so curious to see if we see a difference even just in size class. Because we have such a wide range of juveniles. They can be anywhere from like 45 centimeters to 90 centimeters. And I'm so curious at how much the hormone might vary in those individuals.
That's very cool. I'm glad someone else is doing that, because this is the first time it's been done in sharks, looking at different age classes with 1-alpha. So it needs to be done again in some other sharks. So
working on it.
It's awesome.
Okay, so we definitely broke down a lot of what you found, and it is just so cool. I hope our listeners also found it to be really cool. Are there any other main takeaways that you want to make sure is like super clear that we haven't discussed?
I think one of the major things is that we just don't know what one alpha bee really does. we don't know. And that's one of the biggest things that I try to get out there is this is a totally a learning process from start to finish for everyone. And it's a black box. We have no idea what's happening. Another very interesting thing about one alpha is that there's evidence that bacteria in the interrenal gland might be making it, so that the shark potentially has this symbiotic relationship with bacteria. Again, totally speculative, but we have an honors student working on that research right now. So it's crazy. Like this hormone is crazy. It's crazy to make. It's not impossible to make, but it is it's a very, very interesting molecule. And
but we don't know its importance.
Oh, we have no idea of its importance. And that's why it's really important for us to do these studies, to be very cautious in referring to it as a stress hormone, because at this point we don't know yet. So,
yeah, I think that's kind of breaking my brain, because even before this interview, I thought it was a stress hormone.
Right. Yeah. So we're not there yet, which is the crazy thing. We don't know what the stress hormone in sharks is, basically. So, and that's also why it's really important.
We don't know.
And that's actually what I concluded in this paper. Like one of the final sentences was, we still need to be measuring glucose. We still need to be measuring these secondary metabolites and secondary stress markers, because right now that is the gold standard of measuring stress in sharks. So the hormone side, we're still working on, like your work and all these other studies coming out, like it's all super important to understanding what the corticosteroid side rate is right now. But until we have that data, like right now, the only thing I can say about stress is glucose and like is these secondary stress markers.
Oh my gosh.
Sorry to like throw that bomb on you, I guess. But
Megan can't compute.
I can't compute. I'm like literally thinking about like, oh shoot, I'm about to turn it into a grant that I need to like rephrase, because I definitely.
Oh no.
Like, no, it's all good though. Like it's so good for me to understand this, for other people to understand this. Like it's just so interesting, and it honestly makes me more excited to like get out there and try to help figure out what this hormone is doing. And what is going on?
It makes it more, I think, yeah, more of an exciting question, I think, because all the data you get now, even if it's negative or positive or negative, it contributes to this question. So it kind of opens up some opportunities there, I think, because even negative data is data. So
this conversation is making me think of Edna in The Incredibles, and she's like, who are you? What do you want? That's what my brain immediately went to.
Perfect.
I love that so much. Oh my gosh, that's gonna be like, you know how people have descriptive abstracts or like artistic abstracts?
Paper title.
Yes. Like I'm just gonna have Edna screaming at this hormone. What are you?
Who are you? What do you want?
I always have that, like, in every presentation I have that, like, Katy Perry left shark, you know, like meme, and it always is like, I don't know what I'm doing here. Like, I don't know what's happening. that's it.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
I will say we have been working for almost 4 years on making one alpha bee at our university, so I'm hopeful that we will have some to potentially do more of these important studies for.
Cool. That's like a whole other paper. I can't wait to hear about
it. Is, yeah, we're writing it now.
Can't wait,
send it over.
So before we conclude this episode, we have come to our favorite part, which is asking you for your favorite field story. And this does not have to be from this paper. It can be any field story. It can be in the lab. It can be whatever you want. But we just really like asking all of our guests for their favorite stories, because we've gotten some really great ones.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So I guess the first thing that came to mind was my home field station is Banfield Marine Science Center. So that's on Vancouver Island off the coast of British Columbia. And that's where we work with spiny dogfish. And we actually have to go rod and reel fishing for them. So we go out every night and go fishing for these sharks, and they're not that big. They're like 2.5 feet. They're pretty small. So I had just read a book one night on Canadian monsters, like different Canadian monsters. And there is one off the coast of British Columbia, and it was called Cadborosaurus, and they call it Caddy. And I was just on the boat, and there we were just fishing. It was like pitch black, and I felt something on my line, and I tried to pull it up. And when there's a dogfish on your line, like, you know it's a dogfish. So it's not insane to pull up. Like, it's strong, but it's not insane. This thing, like, wasn't moving. Like, it was, you could feel that it was alive, but it wasn't moving. And then our boat just started, like, tipping to the outside.
Oh my gosh.
And this is like a 12-foot boat. It's not a big boat. And we're right next to the open ocean. So it's like, I don't know. I was kind of freaked out. And in the first thing that came to my head was like, this is a sea monster. This is Cadborosaurus. Like, I've caught a sea monster. So I was ready to cut the line. I was like, this is going to drown us. This is going to sink us. And eventually we ended up reeling it up. And it was this massive, like 3.5 round foot skate. And it was huge. It was this giant skate, and I have pictures. It was crazy. It was, my advisor was also on the boat. He's like trying to pick this skate up over the boat. It's huge. And the reason why it was so heavy was because they just sit on the bottom, right? And they don't move. So,
well, and they're like a flying kite that you're trying to like pull up through the water column.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
all that resistance. And I swear to God, and I was like, this is a sea monster. Like, I swear to God, this is a sea monster. And so I just thought that was my favorite. It's like, I'm dying here. Like, this is where I die. Oh, so gosh. Yeah, that was my favorite, I think.
Oh my gosh.
Mostly because I feel like that logically, that I feel like that's where my brain would go if I had just read about sea monsters. I'd be like, there's so many things we don't know about the ocean. I definitely caught a sea monster.
Oh, absolutely.
And then it's just a skate.
And I didn't even think about a skate. I was like, it's either that or like a sea lion. And either way, it's going to flip over our boat. So like, I might as well just get ready to go into the water. So,
and especially at night, like, that is like, it just like makes it extra spooky, extra unsure, because you can't like see anything. Oh my gosh.
And the pictures of this are all very blurry because no one could see anything. And it's just us like thumbs up, like with this skate, like super blurry photos, like chaos, absolute chaos the whole time.
Oh my gosh. I'm glad that you're still here. I'm glad it was not in fact a sea monster. This is definitely how sea monster stories start.
Oh, absolutely. I kind of wish it was, though. I kind of wish that the sea monster was real, but maybe
I mean, but do you? Because maybe you wouldn't be here.
I know, true. Yeah, I have no idea.
Would have sank your boat.
Yeah, it would have totally.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much, Alex. This has just been like so cool to get to know your research, and I can't wait to keep watching. I'm definitely going to be in contact with you as I try to also figure out what one alpha bee is and why it matters, because now I'm more confused than I was before.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Me too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This has been super fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and where should our sharkies follow you? Where can they find your work?
I do have a science Twitter, and that is science_shown. So just my last name, S-C-H-O-V-N. That's where I post a lot of like the new papers that are coming out, and the other half of my lab does sturgeon work. So a lot of sturgeon stuff as well. And that's probably the best way, I think.
Awesome.
To find me. Yeah.
Okay, sounds great. Well, thank you so much again, Alex, for being here. Until next time.
Swim you later. Hey, Sharkies, if you've been enjoying Sharkpedia like we hope you have been, you can check out our Patreon, which is in the link tree in our bio on both Twitter and Instagram. And also, don't forget to rate and subscribe so that other people can find our podcast and hopefully hop on the train of loving sharks.
This episode was edited by Kayla Shue.